Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds. At CPR's winter meeting in New York in January 2008, the CPR audience was treated to a keynote speech given by the Right Honorable Lord Wolfe of Barnes, who is widely credited as having led rather sweeping civil procedure reforms in England and Wales in the late 1990s. In fact, CPR's chairman of the board, Judge Charles Renfrew, introduced him as follows: "No person has had a greater impact since Blackstone put pen to paper on the civil justice system in England than Lord Wolfe." CPR's president and CEO Kathy Bryan and I had an opportunity to sit down with Lord Wolfe and talk to him about his accomplishments in reforming England's civil justice system, what led to those reforms, what they consist of, what's made them successful, to talk also about the use of mediation, which was given a substantial boost in the UK as a result of those reforms, and to also speak with Lord Wolfe about his activities since he retired as the Chief Justice of England and Wales in 2005. He's since gone on to act as a mediator in very prominent international cases, and is also playing a role as the president of the Commercial Court of Qatar, where he's also helping that country develop its civil justice system. Well, first of all, it's an honor to have you, come and speak.
Let's cut that.
And, well, you know, I think it would be great for people who are interested in CPR to hear what led you to the, also called the CPR reforms, the civil procedure reforms.
Well, I was asked to do it, and it was something I was interested in, because I am interested how bodies work, corporations work, how courts work. And so that's how I got involved in it. And when I got involved in it, I suddenly realized it just wasn't functioning as it should, that it wasn't serving the public. I mean, this was very, very true, that it provided a way of getting a judgment which would make a contribution to developing the law and actually meeting the needs of those who were involved in the process. I soon had very grave doubts. And in particular, in the UK, we had people who, so far as civil justice were concerned, just couldn't use the system. We allow people to bring in their own cases. You don't have to employ lawyers. They can start it off and work the way through it. But it's such a slow process, and it was such a convoluted process, it was inaccessible. And one of the small things that I recommended as a sort of symbol of what was wrong with the system, I have, to a substantial extent, outlawed the use of Latin within the system. And I took all the conventional things and tried to give them understandable titles so that the ordinary litigant who went into the system would understand what they were. Claim form instead of writ. I mean, just tiny examples. I was really wanting to make it accessible. And then I really found that the system could absorb those who became involved in it in such a way that they lost control of it. They had no idea of what it was doing. It takes them over. And what was originally the dispute soon disappeared. And in the English system, what happened, it was being replaced by a battle over costs. And so, judges were telling me what's really at stake in this case, because you'd hear what the issue was, is which of the two parties is going to go to liquidation. It wasn't about the original dispute. That had been lost. And not out of any malevolence. lawyers were not explaining to people before they went into litigation what could happen to them. And what they used to complain about bitterly was I was never told.
So, in fact, the reforms were aimed at leveling the playing field in many respects, right? By helping people become more informed at the outset.
So we started off with a clean sheet, and of course there were others who were involved, because others who had seen the position exactly as I did. And then we started off trying to devise the overriding principles which are now set out in part one of the CPR. And those overriding principles tried to identify what was it that a litigation system should do. And the first one was, of course, resolve disputes. And the second one was to do so justly. And then we had to think, what happens if you're going to resolve disputes justly? And we saw things that weren't part of our system at that time, which were very important. And they immediately came out the fact that the system should resolve disputes proportionately. That if it's a small dispute, you can only justify spending a small amount of money. And so we eventually ended up putting cases on tracks. Now, it was not unique, but if the claims are small, then the situation is that all that you can do to resolve them is provide a summary sort of remedy. And so we now have well-established and very successful in England a small claims procedure, which anybody can walk off the street and do it. It's not designed for the use of lawyers. It's designed to be used without lawyers. We don't forbid lawyers to come into it, but that's what it's for. And of course, it works very well. And unlike the rest of English litigation, where 90% of the cases were settling, we found the astonishing thing. In this area, people didn't settle. And that is because they felt they could own it. They got a result, because you must get a proportionate result in a proportionate time. And they get a result normally in at least 3 months. So they started off, they will have one visit to the court perhaps, not even necessarily that, before the case comes before a judge, and they get a result. And there's just no room for mediation to enter into that sort of area. But there are other kinds of disputes which are of a very different nature. And those disputes also had great problems. First of all, the person who had the most resources had the most power, because they could afford to use the system not to achieve justice, but to reduce justice. So one of the things we did in our overriding principles was put a responsibility on the judge to make what would not be a level playing field as level as possible. And procedures were introduced into the system so that the judge could make orders, which the most extreme was one, gives an example of what I was seeking to do. If you've got a dispute against a chemical company, you think a product which is meant to improve your health has actually made you worse. The resources that you need, if you haven't got legal aid, to prove that are colossal. It can be done in a group action, or as you call it, a class action, but it can't be done otherwise. Well, the little person can't possibly have the resources. And what we would say is all the expertise with regard to manufacturing that product are in the hands of the drug company. And we look at a simple remedy of asking the drug company, as part of this resolution of the dispute in that sort of situation, to get the chief scientist to make a report, the truth of which he would accept responsibility for, explaining what was done to deal with the problem which has happened and whether he is satisfied they did it properly. People say, well, but he's the defendant's a chemist. He will, of course, be biased against the defendant. Well, some would. And it's not perfect. But most of those chemists are really concerned professionals. And if they put their name on something, their professional pride means that they will provide something, and at least it's better. At least it opens the door. And it also creates a situation where the chemist doesn't think it can use its financial power to defeat any case. We heard somebody mention, you know, the attitude, I'll bring 100 lawyers.
Right.
That was part of the system. Now, these are only little anecdotes about small parts, but it was this change in culture that we wanted to do. And perhaps one of the most important changes was to let people resolve disputes as early as possible, using, first of all, the court process. So we have the system of making payments into court to settle a case. And you will know all about that, I know. Whether Cathy does, I'm not sure.
Well, I tell you, the tool that I found, by the way, from your reforms, it was wonderful and that we've used many times, very effective, is the Part 36 offers.
That's what I'm coming to.
That is just marvelous. Yeah.
This is what happens is because we've got a cost shifting rule. That had been always there. And the payment into court or Part 36 offer had always been there. But first of all, it had always only been available for the claimant, and not had always been there for the defendant and not the claimant. And we made it available for the claimant as well. And the principle behind that is that if you make an offer and the other side doesn't settle it, they accept it, and when the litigation comes out, eventually, years later it can be, the party who refused the offer gets less than what was offered. Mm-hmm. Or if the position is that it's a claimant's offer, the defendant has to pay more, then there is consequences on costs, which are very serious.
Which, by the way, if I can interject, if you get your costs on an indemnity basis.
So you get all the costs.
All the costs, no matter what you spent from the day that offer was refused till the end of the proceedings, the other side has to pay you. So it really, you know, a claimant.
It can be significant.
But a respondent. But we make that offer also as a respondent in proceedings. We say, and it does force behavior, which I think is more equitable.
Yeah, that's it. And not only is the costs, the interest can be used. And you could have a higher rate of interest.
In the U.S., the cost refers to the expenses, not the legal fees. So it would be deposition costs, costs for production, things like that.
It's a help.
Court fees.
It's court fees.
It's a minuscule part of 10%? The overall costs, not even. So it actually has very little impact. There's a mechanism to provide that cost shifting in a similar way, it sounds like, that your civil reforms included, but that the impact of it is so minor because the cost themselves
are small. Well, there's no teeth.
It has no teeth.
Yeah.
Right.
And the thing that is critical is that if you're not a person of means, if litigation goes on for a long time, then you just get run out of the money. So there are various ways that you can protect and get the level playing field, which is very important in litigation. Now, this brought me into contact with mediation, and I was particularly keen on exploring this because, if you sit a judge as long as I have, you know there are so many cases where even if the claimant wins, the result is really not going to be the one he or she wanted. That's not really what they're after. And also, the importance of finding ways of cutting through the problems of litigation, no matter what you do, to simplify it. And the dangers of losing control. Now, I think that in mediation it's extraordinarily important that the people who are mediating are in control. And I may say so, one of the things that we've changed in England not as well as I would like, because you've got to keep going back on them. I wanted the litigants to be in control, not the lawyers. And so in the CPR, there are a number of requirements putting obligations on the lawyers to fill the litigant in what they're getting involved in if they enter into a dispute. And it is a very strict requirement that, first of all, the litigant should be told at different stages of the proceedings how much his costs are likely to be if he loses, what is the cost of what the bill's going to be.
Common sense.
This is all common sense.
Yes, absolutely.
Because, you know, again, when I was talking to litigants, and I talked to a great many, who they found that they just didn't hadn't appreciated. And to find a situation where two people were arguing over a boundary dispute, and then both of them had to sell their respective homes, it's not justice. And so it has nothing to do with it. So that was taken up. But it was like going through the process, picking up one thing after another, but starting off from basic principles and doing just what you said, using your common sense. And when one comes to common sense, then ADR seems to me to be just common sense. And of course, the litigants will often negotiate, and the lawyer's initial reaction to ADR is, well, we do it anyway. We don't charge extra for it. So what are you bringing in somebody else, a third person? Mm-hmm. Well, we all know who've done mediations. What if the presence of a third person, who is a true independent, right, makes a very significant difference. And going back to the point about getting results which courts could not do, I mean, one of the advantages of my giving up my job early is I got a certain amount of mediation to do. And I've had each one of them has been fascinating. I think in some ways the most remarkable one that I was involved in was a claim which was brought against our National Historical Society, which is one of the big institutions, by parties of Maoris wanting their ancestors' bones taken back to Tasmania to be buried and not have them buried in the basement of the National Historical Museum. Now, this was something that mattered hugely to the Maoris. It mattered hugely to the museum because they've got a collection. And if you've got a collection of bones, every bone is part of that collection. And that is open to the scientific community for research. And if they gave in on this, what about the other bones? They'd be left with nothing. And so when we saw both sides beforehand, they were really not unreasonable, but all prepared to be reasonable. But there was an intractable, or so it appeared, opposition. The Maori said, this is something which is our basic duty to our forebears who we worship, to see that their bones are brought home and given a proper burial. They aren't buried. Their souls can't rest until they are buried. And on the other hand, this venerable institution, whose chairman was there, saying, you know, I understand and I sympathize, but we just can't create this precedent. Now, to make a long story short, within 48 hours, the arrangements were being made for the bones to go back to Tasmania to be buried, but in the short time that was available to the museum had taken some more samples, tiny, tiny samples, which with great reluctance the Maoris had given in, because the relationship between the two sides was transformed. And the Maoris were trying they saw the problems of the museum, and equally the museum realized just how important this was to the Maoris. And as a civilized organization, they just could not, unless they had the strongest justification, deprive them of what they were seeking. And I attended the ceremony, took place for the handing over, as did the High Commissioner of Tasmania. And what they were doing was they were going to make all sorts of things on a voluntary basis available to the museum, which were important to the museum to take forward. And they, but above all, the basic principle was bones should be buried. And you know, how could any process in a court achieve a result like that?
Yeah,
I mean, I think the probabilities are the case would be thrown out in the air. Mm-hmm. And it would have been no credit to the courts, because they had a really just claim.
Well, you know, the reforms, though, did lead. Was it a requirement of the reforms to try mediation? Because it is now the case in the UK that mediation is not obligatory, but if you don't try it when you should.
Well, it's not compulsory.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's limits to what one can do with regard to sanctions. But what I was trying to do was that any responsible buyer would recognize it. It was his or her duty to make it clear to the litigant that they should mediate, and mediate in goodwill. And what we backed it up with was a power in the court to make orders. And somebody put it, I thought, rather well, the desire to go to mediation was given judicial propulsion. And it was the sort of fact that the judge was there pushing it forward that gave it this impulse. And there's not as much going on as I would like, and there's not enough good mediators as I would like, but it is part now of the culture. And I believe that if they heard what you have been saying this morning, that I think CPR are doing, it would be tremendously powerful. Mm-hmm. It is changing the focus. Mm-hmm. I mean, the conversation about mediation that takes place in alternative dispute resolutions is normally lawyers to lawyers. And this is not judicial propulsion, but client propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that would be quite a nice message to put.
Oh, I agree. One of the things that I think has been so helpful when you have this judicial propulsion is to overcome the perception that offering to mediate is a sign of weakness, and that the important thing we heard this morning, and I hear from my clients, and I know I have felt myself in my roles, is that the earlier a dispute can be resolved, the more money that can be saved, the better the relationship, etc., etc. And so getting over that concern that there's a sign of weakness in being involved is really critical. Was that kind of the thinking you had with the judicial propulsion piece?
Yes, absolutely. It was very, very, very important. I mean, it almost looked as though the solicitor would be negligent if he didn't explain it. And, you know, to say that sort of thing can happen in England just as it happens in the States.
Mm-hmm.
People turn on their lawyers and say, why didn't you advise me on this?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the judges are very forceful. But because it's been, I mean, I was urged by the Australians, mm-hmm. and some people in the States, but especially Australians, you've got to make this compulsory.
You know, it is, I can tell you, for someone who has disputes in many different countries, it is, you know, people tend to point to the UK dispute resolution mm-hmm. today as a model. And you know, everybody goes back, it was April 1999 when the reforms became effective, if I'm right on the date, and how revolutionary it was for the entire legal system. Then I ask, how come the United States, I mean, we're now close to 10 years out since radical transformation, and I think it's no one would say that it was a bad thing. I mean, I think you probably faced a lot of resistance in bringing about the change.
Well, I was determined to get the lawyers on board, and the ironic thing is, before it became into law in England, the lawyers were doing it.
Mm.
They were so convinced, and indeed, I mean, in a few minutes you can't tell. It was trying to take the adversarial aspects of litigation out of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
The use of joint expert reports,
mm-hmm.
so that they both signed up to the same expert,
right.
They choose them together. They both can give instructions to the same expert, and the expert produces a single report. Mm-hmm. Well, you can get experts to say anything. And experts used to be owned by the client. Mm-hmm. So he would say, or she would say, what they were said. The expert's duty was to the court. Mm-hmm. Now, the number of experts who, before my report, told me that they would love to be in that situation. So that they, when the solicitor said, we'd like you to alter this paragraph, mm-hmm. or alter that bit, mm-hmm. they could say, no, we're people of integrity, but, you know, if you have two different stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the U.S., as recently as last fall in a meeting, in talking with a number of senior litigators at a law firm, one of them said, well, you know, mediation doesn't work. Doesn't work. I've tried it. You know, we go through it. We do it for our clients. But, you know, it's just, it doesn't work. Yeah, litigation, and he just proceeded to go on with the benefits of litigation. That was 2007 in the United States. And what I find is that
it could happen in England as well. I wouldn't have rose-tinted spectacles about the English system.
But the individual's view about mediation tends to very much be colored by the individual's personal experience in mediation. And so it's one of those things that, you know, you have to gain to a point where, kind of a tipping point, if you will, where right. enough people have had good experiences, enough mediators are skilled, and then it gains enough momentum that it starts to overcome and grow.
Well, I think that one of the radical transformations that occurred in the UK, which is, distinguishes it, is that it wasn't just a push for mediation. It was a push for mediation in the context of radically transforming the entire civil litigation system.
You know, I'm establishing this court in Qatar at the moment. For them, which is a remarkable thing that we've asked to do. It is, you know, first of all, I'm Jewish in Qatar, and set up a new commercial court for them there. But it's not going to be called a court. It's going to be called a dispute resolution center.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
It's very useful to be able to do it. But at the heart of the system, of any system, is trust. And we've got to trust. We've got to, first of all, to have the trust of the judiciary. We've got to have trust in the lawyers. And we've got to actually make sure that we've got trust in the mediators. Mm-hmm. And as it gets bigger and bigger, I worry more and more about the lack of regulatory environment for the mediators.
Or just standards. Standards,
yeah.
Certification requirements. Yeah. It's both mediators and arbitrators, it's the same. I think it has the potential to be a global profession, but I don't think it is. I don't know if you...
Well, a global profession?
Yeah.
Of course it has. But it will become more of a global profession because of this. We are an international, global market. And you've got such an interplay that there will be people who are just... there's no real difference between a global dispute and a domestic dispute, is there?
No. They
lend themselves. But a global mediator would have had experience of the problems that are involved in global litigation. And that is one of the very real considerations of mediation in that area. Because one of the things you've got to be saying, well, how are you going to, if you get a judgment in your favour, how are you going to enforce it? I mean, you know, if it's in England, how are you going to enforce it?
A little different in China, for example.
Yeah.
Or India.
Yes.
Or India, absolutely.
And so your mediator must have he must be familiar with the type of process in the area which he's dealing with. Now, I take good advantage of asking you things. What does GE think you'll be doing producing these pods?
Well, GE, we believe in transparency. In that sense, what's good for us in learning can only be good for other people as well.
That's terrific.
Well, in the ethics field of global companies, I think the US have been there in the vanguard. I mean, they get into trouble.
Out of painful experience, I'm afraid.
Yes. Well, that's what goes forward.
Yeah.
And it's the reality.
Yeah.
Again, Lord Wolf and Kathy, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.